The history of the early years of the cinema is filled with risk-takers, artists, inventors, and industry pioneers, and almost all of those figures were men. A new documentary offers a bit of a corrective to that history, painstakingly reconstructing the life, artistic output, and business acumen of the first woman director and studio owner, Elise Guy Blaschet. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. The new film, Be Natural, The Untold Story of Elise Guy Blaschet, is a remarkably compelling tale about one of the cinema's most prolific and important early directors and how her contributions were almost lost to time. The film is produced, directed, and written by Pamela B. Green, and I'm very happy to have her on the program today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us by phone from Los Angeles. I have to say, watching the film, that I was only vaguely familiar with the name Elise Guy Blaschet, really just as a name from studying early silent film, but I could not ascribe any weight or knowledge to her accomplishments. I'm curious how you came across this name and figure and decided you wanted to devote such a big chunk of your life to unraveling the mystery of who this woman was.
I found out about Elise Guy Blaschet completely by coincidence. I was watching AMC, that was before Walking Dead and all this new programming.
Right.
And they had a lot of women shows, I think. But I clicked on this show about pioneering women in cinema, and it was a very short blurb about her. That, you know, she wrote, directed, produced all these films. She was the first female filmmaker. She had her own studio. The first female filmmaker was a trivia aspect to me. I was like, okay, you know, who cares? But the fact that she had her own studio, she was producing, she was doing, that struck a chord with me. And I didn't go to film school, so I don't think you need to go to film school to appreciate somebody like this with amazing accomplishments. And I was surprised that I didn't know about her. And I started contacting people, you know, that I work with, colleagues, et cetera. And the more people I talked to, the more I realized how many people really didn't know about her, even though historians argue with me that, oh, everybody knows about her. Well, you're wrong, because you're a very small group, you know, in the world that knows about her. And I wanted everybody to know about her. So I get a little bit of pushback from historians. And my goal when I saw what she had accomplished, when what I saw, what she was saying, when I looked at her films, was to really expose her to the masses. So people that didn't necessarily know about film or weren't experts can be inspired by this amazing entrepreneur and artist.
It is an amazing story and an amazing woman at the heart of it. Just to, for our listeners, to set the time and place for when all of this is happening, can you give us a brief synopsis of when Elise Guy Blaschet was working and how many films she made?
What's interesting to me about Alice is it's not only that she's a filmmaker and that she created all this content. She's one of the true original pioneers in establishing the grammar of cinema. When she started in Paris as a secretary working for Léon Gaumont, it was basically working at a camera store selling equipment. And it's completely by coincidence that she got invited to the Lumière Brothers screening before the famous one that people know in history, early on, friend and family screening, if you will, to show what this medium can do. And it was basically people exiting a factory.
This was the late 1800s?
It was a screening. Basically, she, completely by coincidence, she attended a screening. The Lumière brothers were very close with Léon Gaumont, and she was a secretary, and they invited her as well. So by chance, I think that was her destiny, her fate changed in 1895, in March. She, at the Société d'Encouragement, which is still in existence, she experienced cinema, but not really cinema, more documentation of people exiting the factory. But it was the first time that you could see something that was projected and that was recorded and projected. And she was a daughter of a bookseller, so she was able to really connect the dots and understand that this was not just a technology, that the possibilities were endless if you infused storytelling.
Right. Yeah, that's
and
a good distinction.
History forever.
Right. She was literally present at the invention of the process of moving pictures. But what's so astounding about the story as you tell it and unfold it in your film is that, is as you say, how quickly she recognized and was among the first to recognize the narrative power of cinema and began making films. She was,
yes.
I think, in her early 20s at this time?
Yes, 23.
Amazing.
And she always credits the Lumières as being the people before her creating the narrative. So she's not the first one to do a narrative, but mm-hmm. she's one of the first to take something further. I think that's very special to be able to see something and to bring something to the table that can further a medium. That's what made me excited about Alice, that she really can connect the dots and was thinking from an artistic standpoint and from a technical standpoint, what can I do? How far can I push this? No different than indie filmmakers today that start out small. It's like, oh, I could shoot this on my iPhone. What if I cut this together and do this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, really experimentation, but also creating early content.
Right, and the language of cinema that we often take for granted now watching all sorts of moving images, but to realize there was a point in time when nobody knew how you put images together to tell a story.
Correct.
And she had to create a lot of that grammar, as you say.
Yes, and you know, it's not just writing it, it's getting the actors, it's getting the cinematographer, it's putting it together, the costumes, et cetera, all the things that we take for granted of how things are put together. She thought about all of that, including, you know, production design, and she even edited her own films. And again, I just saw an article in the editor's journal, and they're talking about the initial craft of editing, and they're talking about Georges Méliès, who is her contemporary. That's wonderful, but Alice Guy Blaché needs to be included in every single thing that has to do with early cinema at this point, because it's not just a male-dominated industry at the dawn. There was a woman, and there were many other women that followed. They're just not documented or recorded.
The film points out, I think someone in the film says, you know, it was a new medium, and it brought new opportunities to people. But as a very young woman and former secretary to Léon Gaumont, what do you think he saw in her that he allowed her to just start making these films, or was it initial success of what she made that he just went with it as this young woman and let her do her thing?
I wasn't there.
Right.
But what I can gather from my research and detective work and just looking at footage of a person and reading his letters, you know, we have a lot of letters that even the French could never translate because his writing is like hieroglyphics. We had to have a specialist translate it. He was very introverted and was really about the science. He wasn't, an open, lively extrovert. And I think he appreciated that about Alice. And also, they were a young company. He had just bought the company, and they needed to make revenue. So if this woman is figuring out a way to get these films out for not only demonstrating what we can do with the camera, but to actually make money and, you know, help move the company forward, why would you want to stop that? And also, her taking care of all this stuff allowed him to continue to focus on the technology of the cameras and exploring, you know, the chronophone, which is a sound system, you know, that they were using early music videos. He just wanted to focus on the technology. So to have somebody by his side that can take care of the business parts and correspondence, check the mail, and find a way to sell cameras and interact with the clients, why not?
Amazing. The center part of your film has a number of excerpts from her early films. Luckily, some of them still survive. And they've been wonderfully restored. It is amazing looking at those. I can't say I'm a great scholar of the silent period, but I've seen my share of silent films. And even her early films have a quality to them that if you just showed it to me, I would guess it was from 10 years later. I mean,
yeah.
They are so sophisticated And the way she uses light and composition and movement in those films is way ahead of its time, I think.
I completely agree. You know, when you take on a subject that you want to possibly cover or research or write about or make a film about, you want to make sure that the ingredients are there, that you have the secret sauce,
right,
if you will. And with Alice, before I even took this on, I needed to make sure that the work was something that was good and that I felt was strong, because just because you've accomplished all these things, you know, being a director, doing, you know, all this work, being head of a studio, it doesn't matter. The work needed to stand on its own. That's the most important thing at the end of the day. And she was hysterical. Those beginning comedies, The Drunken Mattress, the way that's put together, mainly because she couldn't afford sets. Leon Gaumont, again, he's a scientist. He's not looking into spending money to create those backgrounds, et cetera. So she negotiates with the chief of police in France at the time to be able to permit these locations. I think she's one of the first people to even deal with permits, you know, chasing that mattress all over the city. You know, there's another film, and it's funny about The Drunken Mattress, just to go back to that for a second. It's such a universal story, how heavy it is to carry a mattress. But today, a younger audience looks at that and they say, wow, this reminds me of college, you know, getting my mattress in my dorm, et cetera. So it's a whole new interest for a younger audience to look at silent cinema through a new lens, but also to show this woman is doing films that live on, you know, 100 years later, and definitely are ahead of its time because of the comedy and the story and the way the point of view is set in some of these films.
Yeah, and there's a certain evergreen notion to the stories and the types of things that she makes. The title of your film, Be Natural, is actually based on a sign that she had up in one of her production studios reminding the actors to be natural. And I think that's another thing that sets so many of her films apart, is the naturalism of the subjects. We often look back at the silent period and particularly early silent films, acting style is a sort of pantomime, a very expressive, over-expressive, and you don't see that much in her films. So she had a real notion from the very beginning of how actors should be on screen that was very modern.
Yes, that's what keeps her films fresh to me, you know, when I watch them. And, you know, when I first called it Be Natural, I got a lot of pushback because they said, what is that? It sounds like a product or something. And I said, what? You know, as a director and even visiting other colleagues of mine on sets, you always hear, just be natural, you know, just do it naturally. You know, show it in a more naturalistic way. Don't overdo it. That's something that we still deal with today. And in fact, in my research, I even found a screenwriter talking about how he visited her studio when he was younger and he saw that sign, and that really resonated with him because he really felt that was such an important part in filmmaking years later. So people attribute the Be Natural aspect to D.W. Griffith. Well, no.
She was a decade ahead of him.
Yes. You know, who does it first? That really doesn't matter to me. People argue that she possibly made a film later because there's not enough documentation. Of course, there's not documentation. These are throwaways. Nobody sees the medium as something that's going to continue on. They didn't think that cinema had a future. To me, if a woman is there at the beginning and she has a 22-year career and she's making all of this content that we can look at, it doesn't matter what year exactly. The fact that we can watch it and enjoy it and be inspired, and we can see that she, I'm quoting somebody, said she took the training wheels off of cinema and really pushed it off to the races. It's very, very special.
What's also special is not only her prolificness in making films. I believe in your film you point out that she made over 1,000 short films.
She wrote, directed, or produced 1,000 films, because some she oversaw, some she wrote,
sure,
some she produced, including 150 synchronized sound films, which are the early music videos, and approximately 22 full-length features.
That right there would be enough to be in the pantheon of early cinema. But in addition to that, one of the remarkable things is her business ability and her ability to run. She created, helped design early production facilities, which mimic kind of where studios went. And when she and her husband, I think it was 1906, 1907, moved to the U.S., she built her own studio and company here on U.S. shores called Solex, which makes her, I guess, the first woman studio head.
Yes, it's unbelievable because she was so into making sure that Gaumont was successful in France. And he even wrote to her and said, Gaumont was the most successful when you were here. You know, I can't obviously include everything in the film, but she comes to America and her husband is working for the Gaumont division for Singing and Talking Pictures. And she says, I'm a woman of activity. I know I can make money. I'm going to start my own studio. So no different than anybody today. She starts off small. She rents a portion from the current Gaumont studio on Flushing. It explodes, and then she builds her own studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey. It's, in 1912, the state-of-the-art studio at that time. And it makes complete sense that she would innovate all these different ways to shoot and create background elements because she's creating content. So, of course, she can say, let's try it this way. Let's move it there. Why don't we do it that way? And the business aspect comes from early on having to survive to keep the company going in Gaumont and also seeing the opportunity in the U.S. with other companies making Westerns and doing all of this content. She comes up with new content, talking about immigration, talking about anti-Semitism, talking about racism, women's issues, putting women at the helm. She made a film called The Consequences of Feminism in France in 1906. She remakes a film in the U.S. in 1912 called In the Year 2000, Where Women Are in Charge. So really putting her personal points of view on society and infusing them in her stories that become films that go all over the world.
Unfortunately, by just after World War One or towards the end of the teens, her company, like a lot of early cinema pioneers and companies, doesn't make the transition as studios are beginning to relocate to Los Angeles. Economic drivers are beginning to force her out. The back half of the film is really fascinating too, how it explores her fight over the next decades to make sure her name or her credit remains. And I guess the film is part of the end of that journey. Is a lot of people are going to know this name, and you've recredited to her with some amazing things. I'm wondering just how you feel now that you're done and you've gotten to know this person so well through so many historical documents and interviews and other things, but to know that her life's work is getting back out in front of people.
It's an amazing feeling because when I started, I kept saying, I wish I met her. I wish I met her. And a filmmaker that I talked to said, you did meet her. By the time you're done, you will know her. As I was making the film, I kept thinking, is it good enough? Is she going to like this? You know, would she like this if she were alive?
Right.
You know, you wonder if you do somebody justice. And I am finally at peace that I feel like I've done everything to be accurate so historians can't come after me. that I've made a film that appeals to a wider audience, and that if she were alive, I think I would have made her proud. And the most important thing, I restored her legacy in a way that's accessible and that will live on.
Alice Guy, at some point in your film, says there is no merit to being first, but I think she would revise that statement today after seeing your film and the recent focus on recovering her film. So really, congratulations on this accomplishment and getting this film out to the world. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much.
I've been discussing the life and work of one of the cinema's most important pioneers, Elise Guy Blaschet, with writer, director, and producer Pamela B. Green. Green's new documentary, Be Natural, The Untold Story of Elise Guy Blaschet, has been touring the country in a limited theatrical release and has just been released on all the major video on demand services, iTunes, Google Play, Amazon, Vudu, and others. You can learn more about the film and its subject at BeNaturalTheMovie.com. On Film's engineer is Seth Van Meter. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.